Thank you for this opportunity to speak at this very interesting conference. So I'm going to talk about a subject which is has both lots of interesting physics and some interesting mathematics. I see if there are a few mathematicians in the audience, so please forgive me, there's some inaccuracies here. Some of them are intentional because I don't want to, I'm intentionally inaccurate, so I don't have to spend my time on explaining math properly. Well, I can instead talk about physics. The subject, I'll first discuss, well, recall what fermionic short-range entangled phase is, and the conjecture which relates its classification, the classification problem to spin cobordisms. And then I'll try to, well, this conjecture is, looks very mathematical, so I'll try to connect with physics by explaining how that works out for a well-understood case of one-dimensional fermionic short-range entangled phases, where one-dimension, I mean, dimension of space, not space-time, so like space dimension is one higher. And then in the more complicated case of two-dimensional phases. And finally, I mentioned some high-dimensional generalizations. Well, of course, the only high-dimensional generalization which is relevant is the three-dimensional one, because the rest is unphysical, but we'll see how what the complications are, I guess. So here are some references. Basically, this work came about by generalizing and trying to understand some work of Gu and Wen on supercohomology description of fermionic phases, and well, as well as all the work on the same subject in low dimensions. So first of all, what is a fermionic? What is a short-range entangled phase? First of all, topological phases are equivalence classes of gapped local lattice Hamiltonians. It can be bosonic and fermionic on whether the local variables on different sites in the lattice commute or supercommute. So notion of locality is different for bosonic and fermionic systems. Well, of course, supercommute means that the degrees of freedom on each site have some, you know, can be either bosonic or fermionic, so there's some sort of Z2 grading mathematically. And whether the commute or anti-commute determined by their grading or fermionic parity. Well, then there's also the trivial phase, that is the ground state, which is the product state. And then there's an operation of stacking together different Hamiltonians or phases, putting on top of each other, that makes the set of phases into a monoid, that is some set with the associative operation, binary operation. It's a commutative operation. It's almost a and then the trivial phase is the neutral element. Now, you cannot usually take an inverse of a phase, but sometimes you can, and such a phase is called short-range entangled. That is, a short-range entangled phase, or SRE phase, is the one which has an inverse with respect to stacking. So, the most important thing about SRE phases is that they have a non-degenerate ground state on a space of any geometry, provided there are no boundaries. So usually people identify topological phases by degeneracy of the ground state, but actually SRE phases are particularly simple. They have no degeneracy, but they're still topological. Now, that simplifying feature suggests that one can probably classify all such phases, perhaps with an additional requirement that everything has a symmetry G. So for simplicity in this talk, I'll assume that G is a finite group, and it does not act, well, it acts unitarily on the Hilbert space, so no time-reversing transformations. Now, here is a conjecture based on previous work on free fermionic phases, namely that bosonic phases with a symmetry G in d-space dimensions are classified by the torsion part of something called the oriented cobordism of BG, and BG is some infinite dimensional space attached to G. So this oriented cobordism is sort of generalized cohomology group of this space. So I don't want to explain what this means, but you know, there's usual cohomology, and then there is this generalized one which is called oriented cobordism. Now, the nice thing about this cobordism is they come in different flavors. There are oriented ones, and then there are spin ones. The natural guess is that fermionic SRE phases in the dimensions are classified by the torsion part of this other guy, the spin version of this cobordism. of the same space BG. And a similar conjecture was made by Dan Fried. Some remarks. I'm assuming that thermal Hall conductance vanishes. I'm not classifying phases here with non-vanishing thermal Hall conductance. That can be fixed, but then I don't want to complicate the matters. In any case, this is a non-trivial constraint only in dimensions like 3, 7, and so forth. Sorry, space and dimension. So it is actually supposed to be d plus 1, not f. Oops. Okay. And then, there's a theorem, which is sort of partially explains this conjecture, is saying that the torsion part of this group actually classifies invertible spin TQFTs, topological quantum field theories in dimension d plus 1. So if you assume that fermionic phases and spin TQFTs are the same thing, then that explains the conjecture, but it's gonna be nice to understand this connection. What's the connection between lattice systems, lattice Hamiltonians, and TQFTs? So let me give an example. So how classification goes in case of a trivial G first. Well, trivial symmetry still means in the fermionic system, still have one non-trivial symmetry, fermionic parity. And then say in these spatial dimensions, this is Z2 classification because the ground state, which is unique, can be either even or odd. Now in D equals one, again, two different phases, the trivial one and the non-trivial one. And the non-trivial, well, they're different by the number of, one way to distinguish them by looking at the system with boundaries. If you look at an edge of a one-dimensional system, it can have either an even or odd number of Majorana zero modes. And that's a distinction between trivial and non-trivial one. So, G here is just the one which acts on bosonic variables. Yeah, fermionic, in principle, fermionic system, the symmetry is either G times Z2, it's G times fermionic parity, or some extension of G by fermionic parity. And here I'm assuming for simplicity that just a product. In two dimensions, actually, it turns out there are no non-trivial fermionic phases with zero thermal Hall conductance, and then same in three dimensions. And then one can continue. It's an example of classification in case of a trivial symmetry group. Now, before I proceed with other examples, let me just recall some terminology. So first of all, for any space, we have its cohomology groups. Like this, with coefficients in an abelian group. And well, in the case of interest to us, one acts as a polyhedron. Then one can compute these groups using simplicial cachains. So what are these? Well, simplicial K cachain is just a function on the set of all K simplices with values in this abelian group. And they form an abelian group because you can add functions, and it's usually called denoted this. And then the important thing, there's some co-boundary operation, which raises the degree of the cachain, and it's nilpotent. And you can compute cohomology, and that's this cohomology groups. So, first, the piece of terminology is that, you know, some K cachains annihilated by this guy are called K cocycles. And sometimes people forget that there's a difference between a K cocycle and a cohomology class. The cohomology class is an equivalence class of cocycles. So, should be careful to distinguish the cocycles from cohomology classes they represent, because in a given cohomology class, you can choose many different representatives. Yeah?
Could you flash the previous slide for a second?
Yes.
I just want to make sure I understand the basic example before the abstractions. So in D equals 1, this is the Kitaev chain?
Yes. And then trivial 1 is the Kitaev chain.
And this corresponds in this theory to the fact that spin Bordism is Z2?
Yes. Yeah, these are precisely the table of spin Bordisms. Well, the torsion part of spin Bordism, or rather it's dual, more relevant ones, Pontryagin dual. Well, it's more precise, okay, here's a mathematical subtlety, which
in dimension one, there is no free part.
Yeah, so the point is that you take the free, you take the torsion part of the spin Bordism and dualize. That's what this table is. Okay, so now we recall what cocycles are and cochains are, so. Cycle is a closed cachain. This is mostly familiar in the case, well, maybe these groups are usually, in physics, more often occur as Deram cohomology groups, but when A is a group of real numbers, but here we're looking at the case when the coefficients are some abelian group. So we need to use a simplicial approach, which is very nice physically, because actually simplicial cocycles basically well, a simplex is basically a lattice, some sort of disordered lattice, so it's actually very natural from a physical viewpoint. Okay, further mathematical stuff. So first, for any finite group, there's some infinite dimensional polyhedron called the classifying space, BG, of the group. And it's determined up to homotopy by the fact that its fundamental group is G, and all other homotopy groups are trivial. And its cohomology groups, one can denote it as cohomology group of BG, but some people just write cohomology of the group itself. It just means the cohomology of BG. And the reason there's a group theoretical description of these guys. Namely, this polyhedron, the way it looks, it's such that a K cachain is simply a function of K group elements with values in this abelian group A. In a K cocycle, it's some function satisfying some linear equation. So one can think about this cachains and cocycles simply as some functions on the K, product of several copies of the group G. So it's completely group theoretical. Well, you ask, what is the cohomology of BG? Well, it can be explained in group theoretic terms. For example, if you have a one cocycle, what is a one cocycle? It's just a function of a single group element such that it satisfies this. So it's a homomorphism from G to A. Very simple. And then, can do some interpret also higher cohomology groups of BG in some group theoretic terms, but it gets more complicated as K increases. So, this is all mathematical preliminaries. And then I can give another example. Let's look at one-dimensional phases, but with arbitrary symmetry. So in that case, it's more interesting. It's also interesting. So we have these triples which classify all phases, and this has been shown first using bosonization, the Jordan-Wiggin transformation from fermionic to bosonic systems, and then you can by Jordan-Wiggin transformation, then you can use matrix product states to classify bosonic systems. So anyway, so this is the answer. So this set of phases, fermionic phases, is like this in one dimension. So you have a degree 2 cohomology class with this coefficient. Well, this is the same as U1, actually. So I just like plug it this way. You can think of it as U1 coefficients. Then there's a Z2 valued cohomology class that is basically a homomorphism from G to Z2. And then there is another piece, which is, it's really just takes values in Z mod 2, because this is always Z mod 2 for any group. So, and on one hand, there's a clear physical interpretation of all this data. Namely, say sigma, which is Z2 value, just counts the number of edge Majorana zero modes, modulo 2. Okay. So, and this other datum tells us, with this homomorphism, tells us whether G, particular group elements, commutes or anti-commutes with fermion parity when acting on the edge zero modes, whether it is whether it changes fermion parity or doesn't change the fermion parity. And finally, this is a cocycle describing the projective action of G on the edge zero modes. So, yes? As a result of what?
G is a global symmetry.
Yeah, you can interpret also that way.
So you can interpret everything.
Yes. Yeah. I just somehow this seems more physical in terms of edge modes. It's a bit trickier to explain all this means when you don't have any boundaries, but instead coupled to background geometry or gauge field. But one can do that too. Maybe actually I'll mention it in the next slides. So yeah, so this is kind of more physical when you think about edge modes. But on the other hand, it doesn't. It's kind of hard to make a connection between this and this spin cobordism picture because, in that case, manifolds don't have boundaries, the spatial ones. So, yeah, well, the claim is that if you have this symmetry G and any one of these invariants in the bulk is non-trivial, then you must have some edge zero modes because otherwise these guys would all be trivial, right? All these guys are defined in terms of. There must be some zero mode, some zero modes on the edges of 1D system. You cannot have basically a zero dimensional system on the boundary, right? You cannot have like non-trivial topological phase there. So you must have some zero modes, if any of this. Well, I'm talking about one dimensional case. Yeah. So anyway, and it's a fact of life that also the same data parameterizes spin bordism group. So it actually agrees with the conjecture. Now, the questions, it's nice, but on the other hand, raise some questions. For example, why? Why is the connection between spin bordisms and fermionic phases? As I said, we know why spin bordisms are now related to spin to QFTs, as Dan and Michael Hopkins explained to us, but we still would like to understand better why lattice Hamiltonians are related to topological field theory. For example, how does spin structure come about in the lattice? Usually spin structure is defined as saying, well, you need that to define Dirac operator in a smooth manifold. But here we're not dealing with a smooth manifold. We have some lattice, some triangulation. What is the Dirac operator here? Now, also another more concrete question, okay, how do I actually associate the lattice systems? Suppose I computed this group and picked some element from this group. What sort of lattice system realizes this fermionic phase? It should be a prescription. And related question, actually, how do we, suppose we know this class. Can we extract any physical information about the phase from this spin cobordism class? How do we do that? Like in this case, I sort of explain how to do it, right? So given this data, which parameterize the class here, I can figure out like all these things, like number of Majorana zero modes at the edge, modulo two, like all these properties of the group action of these modes. But in general, in higher dimensions, how do I do that? Just by knowing this abstract class here. So the questions, I'm mostly gonna focus on this question. Well, these two first, one, two, and three, and I mentioned about four. Okay. Now, some facts about spin structures, because before I proceed, I need to explain what spin structure is. So that, by the way, is a Harvey Crumpet. I recommend this cartoon, very nice. So he collected facts without really understanding them. So here I'm gonna list some facts we need for the discussion which follows. First of all, spin structure is something which you need to define the Dirac operator in a smooth manifold. What sort of topological datum? What sort of topological datum? Well, it's like a flat Z2 gauge field. It's like an element here, but it's not the same. It's like it, but it's not the same. They're literally the same as X is a torus. So when X is a torus, people often confuse the two and say, well, spin structure is just like choosing periodic or antiperiodic conditions for fermions on a torus. But on a curved manifold, you cannot explain spin structure in these terms. Well, here's an example. If you have just S1, which is a one-dimensional torus, you have two spin structures, periodic and antiperiodic. And in string theory, they're called Ramon and Niver-Schwartz. And in math literature, they're called non-bounding and bounding spin structure. Right? They're two spin structures. Also, if you go like in higher dimensional case, in general, there are like some obstructions. Not every oriented manifold has a spin structure. And there's an obstruction called the second Stifel-Whitney class, which lives here. But it turns out that if the dimension of our manifold is three or less, then it always vanishes. So X is oriented here. So for this talk, it won't be important because our manifold is gonna work on up to dimension two or three. Now, more relevant point is this. A spin structure can be defined combinatorially if X is triangulated. So we're not interested in smooth manifold, we're interested in lattices. Now, how to explain the spin structure in that way? Well, one can write a particular cycle representing this cohomology class W2, and then define a spin structure some sort of a one-ka chain with values in Z2 again, whose co-boundary is that two-ka cycle. So in principle, this any such guy, eta, defines a spin structure, but how exactly it defines it is a bit complicated. Depends on the dimension, and because the problem is that this, while the second Stifel-Whitney class, W2, doesn't depend on any, well, it's completely canonical, but choosing a cycle which represents it, it depends on various extra choices. Now, if you have two-dimensional manifold, oriented manifold, then actually there's a very nice combinatorial description, which is canonical, due to actually ITIA, I think. In that case, when you think of a spin structure as a function on degree one cohomology of your space to Z2. So it assigns a plus 0, 1 to every one-dimensional cohomology class, such that this identity holds, so that this combination is the intersection of two cocycles. Now, if the right-hand side vanished, I would say that F is a linear function of A. And the fact that it's actually a constant, this right-hand side, means that actually this function is a quadratic function of A. But it's a quadratic function with values in Z mod 2, in zeros and ones. Well, here's an example. Let's look at T2 case. T2 has a two-dimensional degree one cohomology. You can look on cycle, sort of cycle in this direction, in that direction. and cycles are dual to cocycles. So a two-dimensional spin structure on a T2 is same as a quadratic function of two variables, modulo 2, which with a given, well, with a fixed combination like this. So see, the right-hand side is fixed, that's the dependent spin structure. So here are the three quadratic functions, and they correspond to Ramon-Ramon, Neuber-Schwarz-Neuber-Schwarz, Ramon-Neuber-Schwarz, and Neuber-Schwarz-Ramon. So.
I'm confused by your notation, the second bullet. If W2 is non-zero, how can it be the co-boundary of anything?
Well, as I said, when low dimensions, it doesn't matter. It's always cohomologically trivial in dimension 2 and 3. In an oriented case. It's oriented case. Everything is oriented here. So this description is completely canonical, but it's not very local. So this function doesn't have any like local description. Okay, finally. So okay, let's go back to this issue. So I displayed that formal classification of one-dimensional phases. Can we provide some sort of, concrete lattice model which realizes all of these phases? So there's triples, nu, rho, sigma. I'm not going to explain the general case, but it can be done. Let me just state the example in the case when sigma is 1, but the other two guys are 0. So sigma, when it takes phases in 0 or 1. So 0, because the sigma 0 is a trivial phase, nothing to talk about. So look at sigma equals 1. Well, here's the construction. First, we draw a trivalent graph on x. Imagine it's dual triangulation. And then partition function is a sum over all like one cycles on this graph, that is continuous closed paths on the graph. And it's a very simple model. Each one cycle contributes either plus or minus one to the partition function, just sum up those contributions. And then divide by some normalizing factor. How do you commute the sign? Well, the sign is like goes like this. We place a pair of fermionic variables on each edge of this graph. On each edge of this path, sorry. So there's a graph and the model is sum of all paths on this graph. Like, if your particular edge is inside this path, you put a pair of fermionic variables there, one at each end. And if, the edge is not in the path, you just don't put anything there. So, and then to each vertex, associate the product of fermionic variables adjacent to it. So, if you have a vertex, it's a trivalent graph, so the path just maybe doesn't go through it, and then nothing comes from that vertex. Or maybe there is just one path passing through that vertex. So then there are two fermionic variables attached to it. Just take the product of these guys. Well, in which order? Well, the order in principle should be fixed by orientation of your manifold. That's the order. But, and then you just compute the integral over all these fermionic variables, and the result is clearly either plus one or minus one, because there are as many fermionic variables as there are in the integrand. So get plus or minus one, just coming from the reordering of these guys. But subtly, the result depends on the ordering of the edges around each vertex. But the orientation only gives you a cyclic order. So we can try to say, well, let's specify some additional data. It's called branching structure on the graph. Essentially, pick one edge as the first edge for a priori vertex and then go from there. But then the result depends also on this branching structure, and the partition function also depends on this unphysical choice. So what do we do about that? So it's not quite the final product yet. Here, but the spin structure comes to the rescue. So one just replaces the naive partition function with a corrected one for each path. Just correct it with a sign. And the sign is this one cocycle eta satisfying this guy. And this guy, W2, is also determined by the branching structure in some variable specified way. So the point is that this guy, Z of P, depends on all these unphysical choices. And this guy also depends on physical choices. But the product actually doesn't. In fact, it's that sine function, well, which I defined before, which depends on the spin structure, which is completely canonical. And so with this correction factor, that's a completely well-defined fermionic lattice model. And that gives you this Kitaev, sort of Euclidean picture of the Kitaev chain. One can also reformulate it in Hamiltonian form, and one actually gets precisely the Kitaev Hamiltonian from this formulation. Okay. Now, an important remark is that this sum over all paths can be interpreted as a sum over Z2 gauge fields on the dual triangulation. So, all summing over cycles, but you can also think about this as a cocycle in the dual lattice. So when you sum over a gauge field, it's like gauging something. So what are we gauging here? We can think of this whole thing, well, at least in the case which explainingly zero, nu, and rho, as a kind of spin structure dependent gauging or bosonic system with a global Z2 symmetry. That system is essentially like a topological version of the Ising model, because you can imagine like just coloring each vertex of the dual triangulation with one of the two labels. And then this path, such as boundaries of domain walls between different, like, well, each, you can imagine like each vertex defines some state of matter around this vertex, and then this path just separate domain walls, like in the Ising model. We're just summing over all configurations of domain walls with a weight which depends on the spin structure. So that's what this model is. So the net result is we start with some very simple Z2 system, Z2 symmetric bosonic system, and somehow gauge Z2 symmetry and get a fermionic system, in this case, Kitaev chain. So, and that's a can be thought of as fermionization or bosonization, depending on which direction you think about.
So the bosonic system evaluates W2 on a closed surface and puts that in as a sign?
No, bosonic system is just very trivial one, sort of trivial partition function, just sum overall configuration of and then when you gauge it, you say, well, this particular configuration of domain walls is attached, corresponds to a particular sign. So that sign is not part of the bosonic system, it's part of the sort of gauging process. Now, I would like to generalize this picture to higher dimensions. Here I need an interlude, so about generalized global symmetries. So recall, so a continuous p-form symmetry has a p-form as a parameter. That's something which is common in string theory, might be something in condensed matter applications. Now, a continuous global symmetry has a closed p-form as a parameter. So the notion was introduced fairly recently, but it's very convenient, and illuminates many things. For example, if you have a Maxwell theory in any dimension, then you can shift the gauge field by a closed one-form that doesn't change the action. So that's an example of a global one-form symmetry. Now, if you switch from continuous symmetries to discrete ones, then a discrete p-form symmetry has a pico, a discrete gauge p-form symmetry has a pico chain as a parameter with value in some abelian group. And a discrete global p-form symmetry has a pico cycle as a parameter. So it's a closed, has a closed pico chain as a parameter. For example, let's look at Z2 gauge theory, kind of analogous to this example. In any dimension, you have a global one-form Z2 symmetry, which shifts your Z2 gauge field by a flat Z2 gauge field. It's because the action only depends on the curvature of the Z2 gauge field. So if you shift it by a flat one, nothing changes. Well, it's actually a very useful viewpoint because you can discuss many things in parallel for this generalized global symmetry. You can have anomalies, they can be spontaneously broken, etc. And let me give an example of how this is useful in formulating bosonization in two dimensions. So the claim is this, bosonization of a two-dimensional fermionic system, that is two space dimensions. It's a bosonic system with a global one-form Z2 symmetry and also some non-trivial Hooft anomaly, which is trivialized by choice of spin structure. Okay, that's a mouthful, let's explain what this means. First of all, a global one-form Z2 symmetry is such a symmetry of the action which is parameterized by a flat Z2 gauge field, that is an element of this cohomology group. Second, anomaly means actually you cannot gauge this symmetry. It is local, but you cannot gauge it, at least if staying within the confines of the bosonic theory. However, somehow it can be gauged with supply spin structure. That's what it means. This anomaly is trivialized by choice of spin structure. Let me explain how this goes. What does it actually mean to trivialize something using spin structure? Well, first of all, one way to think about at Hooft anomaly is that the corresponding global transformations act projectively on the Hilbert space. That was first observed by Fadeev and Shradashvili in the context of Young-Mills theory and chiral anomalies there. But it's also true for this, in this different context where we have not usual one symmetries, but these generalized symmetries. It's still true that any anomaly translates into projective action of the symmetry group on the Hilbert space. So therefore, we're in two space and dimensions, so let's Y be a compact two-dimensional space. Now, we expect the Hilbert space to carry a projective representation of this global symmetry group, which in this case is just this. That is, suppose you have a unitary corresponding to some particular element here. So then we expect in general the product to be based on a rule like that, and this particular phase, which is really just a sign because the integral here is just 0, 1. So This is just a sign. So UA, UB is plus minus one, plus or minus one of UA plus B. So what does it mean to remove this anomaly? Well, we'd like to redefine this unit tree. For example, like this, where f of some function on the cohomology, taking values of z mod 2. So if it satisfies this equation, then you can easily see that these tilded u's obey the normal rules, that is, non-projective ones. Doesn't mean that this anomaly is actually a fake anomaly. Well, not quite. Two problems with this. First of all, these functions f of a, which is described, they're non-local. And also, picking such a function, as I explained before, the same as picking a spin structure. That's unnatural in the bosonic theory. So what is the way out? Well, the way to do that is like this. Instead of just saying, well, I redefine in some this use in a bizarre way, which is non-local, that wouldn't be like a well-defined local system, I can say, well, let's actually, in fact, tensor our bosonic system with a very simple non-dynamical Fermi system, which has the same global Z21 form symmetry and sort of same anomaly. Once you tensor them together, the anomaly cancels, and you can, and you get a normal representation of H1 and no anomaly. And then you can gauge this Z2 symmetry. But the result depends on spin structure, because this fermionic system depends on spin structure. If you wish, this unitaries in this fermionic system, even though it's very simple, it depends on the choice of spin structure. So that's how spin structure gets rid of the anomaly, and that's how you can gauge. Well, it has a zero Hamiltonian. You just have some rules for, you know, when you try to gauge. It's a functional integral, yeah. Well, it's a lattice system, so I'm just kind of here in the Hamiltonian viewpoint. It's a Hamiltonian viewpoint. I can also do it in a more complicated way in a Euclidean viewpoint. But here it's two-dimensional space, and the Hamiltonian, I just attach to every plaquette, Fock space, and this, well, either attach or don't attach, depending on what the value of the Z2 flux is for that plaquette. And that's all the reason. So you get a Fock space, but, you know, its size depends on what the configuration of the Z2 gauge, Z2 two-form gauge field is. And then I write some, this zero Hamiltonian, and I write some unitaries in that space, which implement this one-form symmetry. That's all that there is. Okay, so non-dynamical means zero Hamiltonian. So that's how spin structure allows you to get rid of the anomaly. And that actually leads to classification of two-dimensional, most general phases in two dimensions, labeled again by triples. The equations are a bit more complicated. So, like this. And actually, and this, well, the equations are fairly simple, but the abelian group structure on this is highly non-trivial. One can show that actually this is precisely this three-dimensional spin cobordism group, so it all works out. But now I have a recipe, actually. For any such triple, I can construct a lattice system which realizes this triple. And if sigma, parameter sigma is zero, well, sigma now is a one-dimensional cohomology, let's say homomorphism, and this becomes super cohomology model of Gu and Wen. You can also reformulate this whole thing as a bosonization, well, as a bosonization or something. I'll just say that in higher dimensions, bosonization also works. Each fermionic system has a bosonic shadow, but with a global D minus one form Z2 symmetry. Again, this symmetry has that Hooft anomaly of a special kind, which is trivialized if a spin structure is chosen the same way. Now, in dimension, well, anyway, let me just say that the bosonization of all supercohomology phases actually looks very similar. They all look like some Walker-Wang model of the suitable G action. So it's a very concrete lattice realization of all supercohomology phases. But one can also do it more generally for non-supercohomology phases, which also exist. Well, let me say the conclusion. So fermionic state sum models require spin structure to get rid of unphysical choices, like some branching structure, whatever. Bosonization then extends to all dimensions, at least in topological limit. And to see this, one needs to make use of these generalized global symmetries, which are very, very useful here. And finally, once in dimension higher than two, some fairly fancy topologies are required. The kind of topology I actually skipped when I was learning topology, like Steenrod squares, Stiklewitney class, kind of, okay, that's not important in physics, who cares? But, well, we know now it's not true, like topology is important in physics, like as this year Nobel Prize in physics attests. And as another Nobel laureate said, the times are changing, And we'll learn about steam root squares. Okay, thank you.
Sorry. I mean, I couldn't follow all the math details, but so let me ask some general questions. For example, for a system with like a one form or even higher form symmetry, so are they really short range entangled state, meaning that entanglement entropy only follows area law? There's no.
They're only local degrees of freedom, and the Hamiltonian is all local. So
but the symmetry. Okay, so you're saying it's built with a local Hamiltonian.
Yes.
What about the spectrum? So it's a gapped Hamiltonian, or
yeah, it's all gapped.
Okay. Another question started for the fermionics. So for example, if I want to talk about a system built with the electron, then there's a constraint between consider a system with the U1 symmetry, right? Then there's a constraint between the charge and the statistics, like the charge one only fermion. And charge 3 can also be fermion, but charge 2 and charge 0 can only be boson. So is there such constraint in your
In this talk, yeah. In order not to complicate this discussion, I did not impose this constraint.
Uh-huh.
However, one can impose there are versions of this cobordism approach, which
okay.
incorporates the constraint.
So Dan's talk will have.
Perhaps, yeah.
Okay. Okay, fine. Yeah.
So again, clarificatory question. So do I understand correctly that for each such short and entangled fermion phase, what you're doing is to gauge the fermion parity, and then you add together a layer of some non-dynamical fermion being the same Hilbert space, and you try to understand those gauges.
Well, I kind of like to think in the opposite direction. Like in general, actually, I don't know how to go start with fermionic phase
yeah.
and go back to the bosonic ones. So there's some gap here. I rather am conjecturing that every fermionic phase can be obtained from a bosonic phase by condensing some fermions or gauging some anomalous symmetry. So it's kind of more like fermionization rather than bosonization that I'm describing.
Okay, but in the reverse direction, is this what you're doing?
Yeah, I think it's basically gauging fermion parity. Like for example, in for one-dimensional phases, there's a very explicit formula for the partition functions, which basically says that to get a bosonic partition function, you take fermionic partition function and average over all spin structures. Mm-hmm. So you can interpret this gauging fermionic parity, right? So that's a precise formula like that. In higher dimensions, similar formulas hold. So. Yeah.
So in general space-time dimension D, this state sum construction will have a sum over some d minus 1 form z2 gauge field?
Yes. But in general, well, test that for sure, but it might also have lower dimensional form fields. Because basically, so in low dimensions, you're just condensing fermions. So you have like sum over paths of particles. That's why you get this d minus 1 degree form field. But in high dimensions, you can also be able to maybe should condense high dimensional objects, which corresponding gauge field would be of lower degree. So you might have to sum over forms of various degrees to get to this your phase that you want.
I see. And in the three space time dimension,
yeah.
you have explicit.
I have two very naive questions. So the first one. Is there some kind of continuous limit where your lattice description applies?
Actually, I was trying to, it's hard to explain. Well, when you're working with discrete symmetries, it's kind of hard to work with the continuous limits. So.
But could you, for example, have some smooth manifold and then say any triangle? So this, you can pick up triangulation and do your approach, but then also show that it's independent of the triangulation that you
Well, it's certainly true in low dimensions because there, so a lattice system, you end up, but in the end, everything depends on the spin bordism class or something like that will be manifold. But in higher dimensions, there are different kinds of categories of manifolds. You can have like smooth manifolds, topological ones, what's called PL manifolds. And I'm not sure which is the, what information is preserved in the physical system. It's actually quite possible that in higher dimensions, not very physical ones, but still, higher dimensions, the smooth structure is not the only thing you need to know. Maybe there's some more which is what the physics remembers. So I'm not sure about this actually.
Yeah, so the other question I had was if we know from Kitaev's periodic table, for example, that there is a distinction if you have interactions or you don't. And so I wonder how you can take such a limit in your case.
I cannot remove the interactions. This is all interaction case.
Yeah.
So it's kind of impossible in this, I think, in the approach to sort of turn them off.
In the two-dimensional case, how much of this topological data can be detected by a fermion parity defect or a pi vortex of the fermion?
Yeah. So parity? I didn't have the time to state it, but all these parameters in two-dimensional case can be rephrased in terms of properties of defects, just like in one dimension. Well, in terms of either properties of edge states or properties of defects. Actually, even in 1D case, I didn't say how to do it using the bulk approach, but the interpretation. For example, that parameter sigma. In 2D case, means the following, that if it's non-vanishing, it means that you have a symmetry defect, like the main wall for a symmetry transformation, then it has the same properties as a Kitaev chain. So it's a homomorphism, right, from the group to Z2. If it's non-trivial, that means that this symmetry defect has a Kitaev chain.
For condensed matter system, as Duncan mentioned on Monday, I think in general there's no Lorentz invariance, even no Galilei invariance. So if we just start from like a lattice model condensed matter system, for example, fractional quantum Hall effect, the UV cutoff model, the lattice model, there's no spin structure. So of course, in certain limit, we believe that the low energy effective theory is described by like a spin chain Simon theory. So when you talk about the spin structure, do you really mean it's like emergent spin structure at a low energy, or it's must
no,
be
No, I think in the end, manifold. Your lattice system comes from fermions, and fermions, like if you really look at deep in the UV, you know, they're still, they really come from fermion interacting fermions, electrons and protons and stuff like that.
But in condensed matter system, we can just cook up like a spinless fermion. Just some lattice fermion model without any spin structure.
Well, I think it's actually, if you look really closely, you'll find that you need to introduce spin structure if you want to get rid of some weird choice associated with like choices of branching structure, for example. You have to do that, and that is, if you're okay with having some branching structure dependence, you don't need spin structure. But if you're not okay with that, and physically I don't think it's acceptable, then you can get rid of it, but the expense of depends on spin structure. And I think in an actual physical system, because everything's made of actual electrons and protons moving in our continuous three-dimensional space, spin structure is the physical datum, not the branching structure. But we can talk about it after the lecture.
Any more questions?
Just a naive question. Are there PL manifolds in four dimension where spin structure cannot be defined?
I don't in four dimensions? Sure. I mean the Euclidean four manifolds. They're Euclidean four manifolds without spin structure. Like CP2 takes a complex projective plane that doesn't have a spin structure. But it can be triangulated.
So in 2+1D, people use this Kösterlin orientation to, you know, model the spin structure. Is there any analog of that in higher dimensions?
Yes, basically what I'm describing. Okay, so lots of ambiguity in how you describe spin structure in a lattice. So in two dimensions, this is Kösterlin orientation approach, which is essentially, it's different from branching structure approach, but it's equivalent. Now, I don't know literally about how generalized Kösterlin orientation to higher dimensions, but in a sense, okay, so Kösterlin orientation defines spin structure only if you choose a dimer, dimer cover of your space. And there is some way to interpret that trivialization condition of W2, some sort of dimer condition. So, but again, when you try to get into detail, there's always some ambiguity in how you latticize your spin structure. So you need to choose, make additional choices. And in two dimensions, even in two dimensions, what I'm doing is strictly distinct from Kösterlin orientation, although it's equivalent to it.
All right, I guess we're right on time. Thank you, Anton.